Good morning and welcome to our final session on the civil rights movement with Dr. Derek Woodard Lehman. This has been a great pleasure and we're looking forward to this final session. But first, I want to remind you that next Sunday, the seminar meets 1 hour earlier at 8:45 because we have the one service Sunday. But we have coffee in the Welcome Center. They have volunteered to make us coffee. So that'll just be great. So spread the word. The seminar, it will start 3 weeks with Dr. Suzanne Free, who's going to talk about Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower, that's about his experience during the Holocaust and the whole difficult matter of forgiveness. She has done much, much work on this and has taught on it for many years. And I think it will be something that will be especially meaningful in a time when anti-Semitism is rising. And that's one of the reasons she wanted to teach this. And so let's support her. And now, our final session.
Good morning. I feel like I should tilt this way. Everyone is all on the outboard side of the chapel today. Before we start, let me say thank you so much for coming and for being here each week and for having me. It's been a real treat. And let us pray one last time before we begin. God, give us open minds to learn, open hearts to love, and open hands to share. Amen. Well, this is our fourth and final session of our series, Democratic Faith, the Witness of the Civil Rights Movement. Our topic today is Living the Legacy, Keeping Faith in Politics. Today, we'll try to draw together some of what we've been over these past 3 weeks in order to draw out inspiration and instruction that we can draw on in our contemporary situation. Our title slide this week picks up on themes from last week. We see here a scene from SNCC's Atlanta office, the central office in 1963, in which James Forman leads singing with Judy Richardson and Gene Wheeler. We see Marion Barry, John Lewis, and Julian Bond in the background. Bond, whose satirical summary of the movement has served as a point of departure for this series. Rosa sat down, Martin stood up, the white kids came down and saved the day. Our main purpose through these past 3 weeks has been to retell a longer story and to recover a larger memory of the movement. Eddie Glaude makes the same point with an anecdote about his now grown son Langston from when he was in the fifth grade during Black History Month. And Langston came home and told Eddie, "Daddy, it's like Dr. King is the only person in Black history." This is from his book, Democracy in Black, the chapter entitled Restless Sleep After King's Dream. Glaude goes on to note that the king we tend to recollect, the one that we commemorate that Monday in January, is what he calls a whitewashed king. The king of the I Have a Dream speech, not the king who protested the Vietnam War in his sermon at Riverside Church beyond Vietnam just a year before his assassination. Not the pro-labor king of the Memphis sanitation workers' strike, where he was when he was assassinated a year later in 1968. So our work thus far has been to look beyond King and to try to read between the headlines of the story that we know, and to break out of this truncated memory and this desiccated narrative to recover the full density of the movement and to retrieve the wider diversity of its leadership. Now, before we draw things together and draw out some implications we can draw on, let's just remind ourselves of all we've done so far. In week two, we reached back deeper into history to figures like A. Philip Randolph, who organized the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union, to figures like W.E.B. Du Bois and Ida B. Wells, who founded the NAACP and began its anti-lynching campaigns into the 1920s and 1930s, and eventually organized the legal campaigns leading to Brown v. Board. Miles Horton founded the Highlander Folk School in 1932, a full two decades before Rosa Parks would come for workshops that prepared her for that stand or that seat that she took in 1955. Here in Pittsburgh, an op-ed to the Pittsburgh Courier started the Double V campaign, victory over fascism abroad and racism at home. Following the war, President Harry Truman desegregated the military and established a standing civil rights commission. We also said that same year, 1947 to 1948, Baird Rustin organized through the Congress for Racial Equality a journey of reconciliation, which was the precursor and forerunner of the Freedom Rides. In 1954, Septima Clark and Asa Jones began their educational work on the Sea Isles of Georgia in the citizenship schools and the freedom schools. And all of this leads to a series of court decisions prior to the famous decision of Brown v. Board, that decades-long legal challenge leading up to that single landmark case, a period of which we mark the closure of with the 1957 Civil Rights Act, the first Civil Rights Act since Reconstruction. Through the work of Wells and Du Bois, which we talked about but didn't go into, there were several attempts to pass anti-lynching laws in the Congress through the 1930s and 1940s. There was a longer boycott of buses in Tallahassee, Florida. Of course, the Battle of Little Rock that we talked about at some length, and the Nashville sit-ins organized by James Lawson, led by leaders like Diane Nash and Bernard Lafayette, among others, which inspired the larger sit-in campaign across the South, leading to the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The work of SNCC included the 1961 Freedom Rides, the 1961 Albany Movement, and the first part of the 1963 Birmingham campaign, as well as we discussed last time, the multi-year Mississippi Project, which included the 1963 Freedom Vote, Freedom Summer in 1964 with its freedom schools, and of course, the sad and tragic kidnapping and murder of those three civil rights workers, including Goodman, who'd just been there for a few hours having come from his training. All of this led to the founding of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and their challenge at the Atlantic City Convention of 1964. Despite the failure of that challenge and the disillusionment that it precipitated, the movement pressed on. 1964 also marked the next Civil Rights Act, which was followed in 1965 by the Voting Rights Act, largely as a result of the Selma campaign. And during the denouement of the movement, to which we may return if we have time today, Julian Bond was elected to the Georgia State Legislature. James Meredith conducted his March for Freedom, at which Stokely Carmichael first proclaimed the need for Black power. And of course, in 1968, King's own assassination, as well as the Black Manifesto delivered by SNCC Chairman James Forman to Riverside Church in 1969. And of course, lest we forget, Ella Baker, the mother of the civil rights movement, whose grassroots organizing work with the Young Negroes Cooperative League, the NAACP, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and SNCC was not only the background of the movement, but indeed was its backbone. With this reminder, what remains today is to try to draw things together and draw out some implications for our own present situation. There are all kinds of ways to understand the civil rights movement and particularly the place of Christian faith in it. As a simple matter of historical fact, it was a church-based and church-led movement. Most participants and almost all of its most important leaders were Christians of one stripe or another. We know this well, even from the standard story. And we know how important practices of preaching and singing and prayer were. And we'll return to those in a moment. But I think one of the best ways to approach and to frame faith inside of the civil rights movement is through the idea of public theology. Is that a term that's familiar to you, public theology? Shaking heads no. It's a little bit stranger. It's a more exotic species than some other kinds. Say again. Public theology? Theology. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the places we can begin to understand what public theology is and what it does is this famous passage from the prophet Jeremiah, chapter 29. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles who I am sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will find your welfare. This text, as you likely know, is written during one of Israel's several periods of exile. It does not promise deliverance from the oppressor. It does not portend a return from exile, at least not these verses. But rather than instigating an adversarial relationship with the wider society in which the Hebrews find themselves, this prophetic passage imagines a mutual and reciprocal relationship with those otherwise regarded as the enemy. Just as Jesus in the Gospels would later tell us to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us, Jeremiah tells Israel to pray for their captors and tormentors. Moreover, the prophet says that the welfare of this alien city is the source and location of their own welfare. Now, in our context, welfare is something of a tricky word. Welfare means public assistance. Welfare is a handout. If you take it, you're on the dole. As a result, the word welfare often has negative connotations. However, the Hebrew word here is the more familiar word shalom, which is nuanced and textured with a range of connotations. It means peace. Christians and Jews alike often use it as a greeting or a departure, shalom, peace, when we greet, when we depart. It has connotations of flourishing, both in the sense of the material provision of fundamental goods and the social expression of basic interests, and flourishing not in a rather low level, minimal scraping by sense, but with a modicum of prosperity. And in the prophetic imagery of scripture, it is often a kind of peace that, as King so often says, is not merely an absence of conflict, but the presence of justice. Here in Jeremiah, we find the lineaments of both a public theology in general and the public theology of the civil rights movement in particular. Public theology in general and in the movement is rooted in that Christian commitment of love and justice. But it extends those commitments beyond the church to society, from discipleship to citizenship. In so doing, public theology seeks the common good, not just promoting the interests of Christians. Now, although there are almost as many versions of public theology as there are public theologians, for my money, Jeff Stout's simple, plain-spoken, straightforward definition is probably the best. He says, if you express theological commitments in a reflective and sustained way while addressing fellow citizens, you're doing theology publicly. And in that sense, you're doing public theology. So anytime any of us takes our faith out into the world as part of our conversation, part of our action and interaction with fellow citizens about our common life, congratulations, you're a public theologian. We can enhance and refine Stout's definition by expanding it beyond expression to include exhibition. Here, Stout emphasizes reflective, self-conscious articulation of faith, but I think we ought to also include unconscious, non-reflective, implicit exhibitions of Christian faith. Together, as both expression and exhibition, the commitment to offer a way into the various ways that public theology expressed itself in the civil rights movement. Now, in some places and some persons, that theology is highly visible and rather obvious. Of course, Martin Luther King Jr.'s speeches and sermons are all biblical Jeremiads against Jim Crow. Faith and theology, biblical quotations by chapter and verse are on full display. So too with the Nashville group. James Lawson, Diane Nash, John Lewis, and others are explicitly Christian pacifists. And recall that Fannie Lou Hamer was simply known as the lady who sings the hymns. In other places in the movement, that theology is a little bit less obvious, and sometimes it's so far in the background as to be invisible. Ella Baker, Bob Moses, and Baird Rustin were all Christians, but theirs was a faith more shown through deeds than expressed explicitly in words. And that's often what we find in the deliberative practices of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We might think of these differences like this. Those explicit expressions of theological commitments and Christian faith are something like speaking a language fluently. These more implicit exhibitions is like speaking another language, yet still with the accent of your mother tongue. Even though you no longer maybe quote the Bible chapter and verse, your speech remains inflected with those same images and idioms. It's infused with the tone and timbre of the church. Now I want to catalog some of those implicit and explicit elements of the civil rights movement. The theme of our series, of course, has been democratic faith. Faith first and foremost in the obvious sense of Christian belief and practice. The ways in which, as historian David Chappell tells it, the movement was driven by the commitments of prophetic Christianity. In Chappell's view, which I believe to be correct, the civil rights movement is best viewed not as a political movement with religious undertones, but rather as a religious movement with political implications. Chappell identifies a handful of these prophetic religious ideas that, in his words, made the movement move. First, he says, the movement and its prophetic Christianity had a realistic theological anthropology. That's a fancy way of saying the way in which it understands human beings, who we are, how we act and interact, was realistic, particularly insofar as the movement took sin seriously. The movement didn't see Christians or fellow citizens through rosy colored glasses. Though optimistic and hopeful, it was all too clear to the participants just how sinful and oppressive American society was. Second, when this anthropology is applied socially, it issues in indictment of institutions and criticism of social structures. Reinhold Niebuhr, whom King studied extensively during his PhD at Boston University, puts the matter like this. Humanity's capacity for justice makes democracy possible. Humanity's capacity for injustice makes democracy necessary. Now, we may tend to think of both democracy and the civil rights movement as idealistic, that is, high-minded, thinking of ideals. And in a certain way, they are. But seen in this light, democracy both appeals to what Abraham Lincoln called our better angels, even as it deals with our baser nature, that capacity for injustice that Niebuhr talks about that makes democracy necessary. For Niebuhr, our base nature is self-interest. This self-interest is compounded and intensified when it's aggregated into groups. On Niebuhr's view, you and I as individuals might act altruistically towards one another interpersonally. We may even act self-sacrificially interpersonally. But when we're grouped together in whatever kind of groups you want to talk about, racial, ethnic, political, ideological, religious, or so forth, groups tend to act only in their self-interest. On Niebuhr's view, groups don't make space for other groups unless they're forced to. So unlike King, for Niebuhr, this means that love is what he calls an impossible ideal, at least in terms of public life. In public life, we're left with justice and offsetting self-interest. Of course, King and others in the movement didn't hold that part of Niebuhr's realism. Recall in Snick's Snippet of Purpose, they said, our goal is a social order of justice permeated by love. Seeking justice through love, the movement embodied its social criticism through nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience. First and foremost, those early student sit-ins and the later campaigns of SNCC, somewhat belatedly and more limitedly, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference got more and more involved in nonviolent direct action. For most in the movement, these weren't merely prudent tactics. We'll give it a try and see if it works, but they were instead profound religious and spiritual commitments. For Rustin, who persuaded King about nonviolence, for James Lawson, who led the Nashville workshops, it was Christological pacifism, which is to say pacifism grounded and guided by Jesus Christ and how he lived and what he taught. And this entailed a commitment to redemptive suffering, that is, suffering for the sake of the movement. Again, in the words of Snick's Statement of Purpose, the religious ideal of nonviolence as embodied in the Judeo-Christian traditions was, quote, both the presupposition of their faith and the manner of their action. But not content for this ideal to remain inert, the movement put it into practice through what Chappell calls embodied alternatives and enfleshed possibilities. They not only picketed and made signs saying that another world was possible, they showed it to be actual, if only in nascent and emergent form, through communities inside the movement. Things like SNCC itself and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, as well as a couple of others we'll turn to in a moment. These embodied alternatives and enfleshed possibilities encapsulated the movement's future hope for beloved community, as well as its present enjoyment of that community in its own ranks. To these prophetic ideas, Charles Marsh lays out several practices that we might say kept the movement moving. Did you guys read this? Okay, very good. So these practices, on Marsh's account, embodied the ideals of the movement and enfleshed the alternatives of what American society could be. Perhaps most obviously, as we've already mentioned, the movement's constant singing of spirituals, hymns, and folk songs. The role of song in the movement is widely documented and well recorded, quite literally. If you go online, you can hear tons of recordings of different songs from different places. And we see here this documented visually in several images. In the background, the SNCC meeting from our title slide. In the images on the bottom left, folk singers Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger hanging out in Mississippi during Freedom Summer, and Nina Simone, whose 1964 hit Mississippi Goddamn reported on the violent repression that the student workers were facing. At right, we see the standard image of marchers locked arm in arm singing at full voice. And we have two photographs of the SNCC Freedom Singers. In the bottom image from left, Bob Zellner, Bernice Regan, her brother Cordell, who coordinated the Albany movement, Dottie Miller, and Avon Rollins. You might recognize Bernice Regan as one of the founding members of the a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock, which is what she did after the movement. And she describes the singing of the movement like this. She says, "When I opened my mouth and began to sing, there was a force and power within myself I had never heard before. Somehow this music released a kind of power and required a level of concentrated energy I did not know I had." So singing wasn't just a way to pass the time. It wasn't just a filler in the program. It was a practice that brought people together. Singing in unison is a unifying practice. And as Bernice Regan says, there's something about the power of song, particularly songs of faith, that awakens us to the power of the spirit inside us, among us, and between us. And it was a source of not only comfort, but courage in the face of repressive violence, knowing the police are coming with the dogs and the handcuffs and the billy clubs. And again, Fannie Lou Hamer, known primarily as the lady who sings those hymns. The movement, particularly in places like Nashville and Mississippi, also involved intensive spiritual introspection as well as extensive preparation through prayer. But prayer itself often was a mode of nonviolent direct action and protest demonstration. We see that here in several images of not sit-ins, but pray-ins. Clockwise from 6 o'clock at the bottom, we see a pray-in vigil protesting the arrest of the Freedom Riders in 1961. Moving around the clock to the left, we see John Lewis with a couple of students praying in outside a segregated pool in Cairo, Georgia. A 1963 vigil in Orangeburg, South Carolina. At top left, around 10 o'clock, we see a group during the Albany movement praying outside of a segregated department store. Towards the right, at about 1 o'clock, we see Fred Shuttlesworth, who was the reverend who sent the buses to rescue the Freedom Riders from Anniston and bring them to Birmingham, and the pastor to who Diane Nash said, "The students have decided. We're coming. We just want to know if you'll meet us." So we see Fred Shuttlesworth in Birmingham in 1963, just before being arrested by the policeman whose bullhorn you can see just at the fuzzy edge of the image. We see King himself just before his arrest in Selma. And at bottom right, we see marchers on the way from Selma to Montgomery, stopping and praying each time they were blocked either by police or mobs. And in the middle, we see a union bus taking people to the first DC march in 1957, the pilgrimage, prayer pilgrimage for freedom, whose flyers and posters we see. That smaller 1957 rally in DC also took place on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And that speech, "Give Us the Ballot," was King's first nationally televised address. Although it was only some 25,000 who gathered and not the 250,000 who would come in 1963, it was a landmark event in the unfolding of the movement and the demonstration that nonviolent direct action could continue to work, could continue to persuade. So for both the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and SNCC, prayer was not only a spiritual exercise, it was a political action. Of course, most obviously, and maybe most prominently, there is the preaching and prophetic oration of the movement. And here is probably where King actually does stand apart from everyone else as the primary spokesperson, though he was not nearly the only preacher or speaker. Recall that night when Fannie Lou Hamer first put her hand up to say she would go register to vote. The meeting was held in a church. It began with a sermon by James Bevel, one of the Nashville sit-in students, and it was followed by a pitch for voter registration by James Foreman. Preaching and activism went hand in hand. One followed from and flowed into the other. The movement, as we've noted at a couple points along the way, also had an extensive educational and pedagogical project built into it. Teaching in both citizenship schools and freedom schools was a big part of the program. On our timeline, we mentioned at a couple points, Esau Jenkins, seen here with his VW microbus and mobile schoolhouse, first started the citizenship schools on the Sea Isles off the coast of South Carolina to educate primarily Gullah citizens so that they could pass the poll test and register to vote. Septima Clark later joined Jenkins and developed and expanded that curriculum and program before she joined Miles Horton at the Highlander School. And both Jenkins and Clark assisted SNCC Field Secretary Charlie Cobb in setting up the Freedom Schools during the Mississippi Project. The Freedom Schools were for school children whose segregated schools were way, 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 way below par. So insofar as the public schools were failing, they set up alternative Freedom Schools. And they also continued the practice of citizenship schools, again, to help people pass poll tests. So all of this, voter registration and education, built toward that challenge to the white supremacist Mississippi Democratic Party through the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in 1964. Although integration was the social and political goal of the movement, reconciliation was its moral and religious ideal. This is what SNCC meant by a social order of justice, that is integration, permeated by love, reconciliation. And again, in that statement of purpose, they noted that integration of action in their own group was the first step towards those goals in the wider society. In other words, in its membership and through its praxis, SNCC already was what it hoped America would become. But in addition to SNCC, there were other entities like Koinonia Farm in Americus, Georgia. Anyone ever heard the story of Koinonia Farm? Yes, no, maybe so. So Koinonia Farm was just a farm in Americus, Georgia. You can see the campus at bottom right with the usual silos, barns, and houses. But it was founded by Clarence. If you read it in a book, it looks like Jordan, but it's pronounced Jordan because this is Georgia. He's there in the middle with a pith helmet driving the tractor. In addition to being a farmer, he was a New Testament scholar who released a vernacular translation of the Gospels called the Cotton Patch Gospel. And he gathered together a community of blacks and whites to live in Christian community on the farm and to engage in cooperative agricultural enterprise. He's, of course, most famous for, along with Jimmy Carter and others, being one of the co-founders of Habitat for Humanity a few decades later. But in addition to being a living, breathing embodiment of integrated, reconciled community amidst Georgia, the farm, like the Highlander Folk School, was a hub for the movement. Students would go there on summer vacation, work the land, participate in the community, and learn about nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience. And in Georgia, it became a place for organizing and mobilizing. Likewise, there's another lesser known organization called the Student Interracial Ministry. The Student Interracial Ministry, or SIM, was a group of 350 seminarians, so students training for ministry, who intentionally placed themselves in pairs, one black, one white, in cross-cultural ecclesial situations. So white kids would go to black churches, black kids would go to white churches as assistant pastors for their field education internships. Do you guys have field ed interns out here ever? Sometimes we got to work on that. This is a great place and we're just over the bridge. That's another story. So SIM grew out of that same 1960 meeting at Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Though less famous than its sibling SNCC, SIM belongs to that same family tree. It was founded by James Stembridge and John Collins when they got back to Union Seminary in New York City. Since Stembridge was a woman and therefore at the time not eligible for ordination, she was also not allowed to do a summer ministry internship. She instead joined Ella Baker in Atlanta at SNCC's office and became its first paid employee. And last but certainly not least, and in extremis, the movement included practices of martyrdom, both in the mitigated forms of redemptive suffering for the sake of their witness, through arrests and jailings, beatings, and all manner of abuse, and all too often through actual death, as was the case with Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, and Mickey Schwerner at the beginning of Freedom Summer, of Alex Wilson being beaten during the Battle of Little Rock, Paul LaPrade and others during the Nashville campaign, of John Lewis and James Peck during the Freedom Rides, and of James Meredith during his March for Freedom. Of course, King himself, as we said, assassinated in 1968. But also beyond these famous cases were countless anonymous Christians and citizens doing the same for the sake of their faith and for the sake of the cause. Like this young man on the left, unnamed and unknown, just a student attacked by police with dogs, in order to confront and contest the Jim Crow regime of Plessy versus Ferguson's separate but equal standard in Birmingham. Thousands upon thousands of organizers and activists and ordinary citizens and everyday Christians did these things. These people come before and stand behind King even as they are overshadowed by him in our standard narratives and our collective memories. As much as we might rightly regard, respect, and recall King, we need to refocus our attention as we have these past weeks, reframe our narration, and remind ourselves that it was not King who made the movement, but it was the movement that made King. And this movement was made by faith, by democratic faith. Another word for faith, not in the ordinary sense of religious belief, but in the second sense that we've been more talking around than talking about so far, is a sense of hope. That stone of hope hewn from the mountain of despair, as King calls it, and that historian David Chappell used as the title of his book. Chappell puts it like this. He says, to know that one is morally right is easy and common. To believe that one is going to defeat one's enemies requires rather extraordinary faith. This faith in victory despite impossible odds is both political and theological. King often delivered that memorable line seen here on the slide, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. This theological and political faith in eventual justice made possible those radical experiments with nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience. Although it is King who graces this bus stop advertisement proclaiming nonviolence, it was Baird Rustin who finally persuaded King to commit completely to Gandhian nonviolence as a method and strategy. And it was James Lawson who facilitated those Nashville workshops with emerging leaders like Diane Nash, John Lewis, C.T. Vivian, and James Bevel, among others. And it was those students who pioneered and proved the efficacy of civil disobedience through sit-ins and SNCC campaigns in Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama. Now, we've cataloged those experiences and told those stories along the way, but we haven't quite spelled out how that all worked. In the basic Gandhian method of nonviolent direct action, you first gather information, discern and decide what needs to be done. Second, you negotiate. You go to the people and say, hey, if you don't open up these lunch counters, we're going to turn up and sit in, give them a chance to concede. You then take action, and then once that action succeeds, you pursue reconciliation on the back end. The idea isn't just to win, but to heal. But nonviolence and direct action, civil disobedience themselves, have a logic and a mechanic. Mixing metaphors, as Archbishop Oscar Romero does, we might call this the violence of love. As we've said a couple of times, for most in the movement, nonviolence was a principle, not merely a tactic. Despite the name pacifism, nonviolence, as we've seen, is a form of militancy, not docility. It is direct action and disobedience. It is confrontation and contestation. Just so, nonviolence is and must be an exercise of coercive force, albeit soul force rather than physical force, let alone lethal force. That force was self-consciously understood as both a dramatization of injustice and a traumatization of conscience. The French philosopher and social theorist Michel Foucault puts it like this. He says the civil rights movement, among other revolutionary movements in the 1960s, were instances of fearless speech. He says the history of thought is an analysis of the way an unproblematic field of experience or set of practices, which were accepted without question, which were familiar and silent, out of discussion, becomes a problem, raises discussion and debate, incites new reactions, and induces a crisis in the previously silent behavior, habits, practices, and institutions. That's a mouthful. But the idea here is that fearless speech is literal speech and also action, so expression and exhibition, that calls into question things that are otherwise taken for granted, that otherwise are not open to question or up for debate. Things like this: the regular social customs and legal regimes of segregation. They were just kind of there and accepted as the way things were, perhaps the way they would always be. But insofar as these laws and practices had to be enforced once challenged, not through social custom and indirect intimidation, but through brute force and repressive violence, the political wager of nonviolent direct action, the democratic faith of those undertaking it, was that by making brute force and repressive violence show themselves for what they were, as we see in these several images, by putting it on full display, particularly through emerging televisual and photojournalistic media, that America and Americans could not look away any longer, that they could not remain apathetic, that as fellow citizens and perhaps importantly as fellow Christians, they would have to respond. And they did, slowly but surely, imperfectly and incompletely. So together, the patient organizing of SNCC and the mass mobilizing of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference brought these things to light, made them visible. In so doing, they brought forth a new era in American society. I think a better one, albeit not a perfect one. So as we begin, and we'll have a conversation in a moment to do that, to think about what this all means for today, we can end where we began, with this bigger picture and larger story of civil rights, depicted here on a map rather than a timeline. More than a bus boycott in Montgomery and a march on Washington, far longer than that decade between Brown v. Board and the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and many, many, many more leaders than just Martin Luther King. Chief among them, as we've seen, is, as we said each week, Ella Baker. Now, as we begin to think of the legacy of the movement, and we'll do that in our conversation in just a moment, We can recall the contrast between King and Baker, between the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. King's famous remark, "Leadership never ascends from the pew to the pulpit, but always descends from the pulpit to the pew," in contrast with Baker's mantra that strong people don't need strong leaders. We can think about that contrast and about the legacy of the movement in terms of those who came out of these two organizations, SNCC and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and what they went on to accomplish. Baker's proteges like John Lewis and Julian Bond went on to storied careers as politicians and civic leaders, whereas King's lieutenants, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, have sort of been around, but mostly off to the side. It's that legacy of organizing, of raising up ordinary people where they are. Again, so many of them with less than an eighth grade education. So not looking for the quote unquote best and brightest, but those who are strong and courageous. And I wanted to leave the last part of our time together this week and in this series open, rather than trying to close with six neat bullet points of what to do now. That may be disappointing, but that was the way I decided to do it. So we have about 15 minutes to try to talk together and to bring together what we've learned and think about what we might do with it in our present situation here and now. So Ted, if you can play Phil Donahue with your roving microphone, we can try to sort this out together.
Yeah, I have a list, but I'll do one at a time. Now, we did visit Koinonia Farm, I don't know, maybe 12, 15 years ago. And I'm remembering the expression that sort of permeated all of it. And they talked about incarnational evangelism. Mm-hmm. So you spread the gospel by how you live. And that's sort of what kept them going, I think. And let's see. That's one thing I wanted to. I have two more things. Our granddaughter was part of the protest. She's at the University of Texas, and she was part of a protest there. And she, from what I could see from the photographs, was a nonviolent resistor. She sat there and didn't move. And then finally, whenever they came, then she stood up and went willingly. And so I don't know that the politics of that whole thing with the Middle East is really complicated. Mm-hmm. But we told her we were proud of her for doing that. And she acted on her beliefs, and it's costing her. She has a court hearing. We're not sure how that's going to turn out, but she did spend a night in jail. So, that's not nothing. Mm-hmm. So anyway. The other thing I wanted to ask is, can you give us an elevator speech for why we should keep faith in politics? Because people are saying, no, you should not mix the two.
Okay, so that's actually a twofold question, so I will give a twofold answer. So we've said there are these two senses of faith in our title, democratic faith. Right? There's the ordinary, straightforward sense of religious belief, and in the context of civil rights, primarily Christian belief. So the elevator answer to why should you keep faith in the sense of religious belief in politics is, the short answer is the First Amendment and the First Commandment. You know, you're allowed to speak freely of your conviction, and Scripture tells us we should have no other gods before God. So how you do that is a whole different thing. You know, I would say those expressions of Christian faith in public life that tend towards, let's take over the government and run the country our way, the Christian way, are probably not the way to go. But talking about the commitments of Christian faith in public life is, you know, fair game. I think the way that we do that is generously and graciously, not, you know, dictatorially. The second one is the harder one. And I think I'm coming back in September to talk about this in the next, my next seminar. Most of us don't have faith in politics, or our faith in politics is lagging in the sense of trust and hope. We look at who's on the ballot and we're kind of like, really, guys? We look online or in the newspaper or on TV or across the street to our neighbors and we're like, I don't know if I trust those folks because they say this or they do that. And so I think the second sense of keeping faith in politics, that is maintaining one's hope, maintaining one's trust, and, you know, showing oneself importantly as being trustworthy to those with whom one disagrees. The polarization in the South in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s surely is as great as whatever polarization we think we're experiencing now. Sure, it's not regional. But if the ordinary participants and the leaders of the civil rights movement could trust their explicitly racist neighbors to change through these radical experiments of nonviolence and civil disobedience, you know, maybe we can trust our neighbors with whom we disagree a bit too. I mean, it's a wild thing to think that in the face of Jim Crow, people thought that could change.
But it did.
So if we are similarly, or if we find ourselves despairing of progress, despairing of change, despairing of consensus, despairing of compromise, or whatever it is that we think we need in our public life and in our politics, whatever the slope of our current mountain, however steep it might be, probably can't be steeper than trying to get over on Jim Crow. So if we can look to the past at an example of extreme polarization, social and political antagonism that was confronted, contested, and defeated, then we probably should think less about giving up and more about getting organized in our present situation of polarization, I guess is one way.
So I would add, just to cut to the right to the chase, a fundamental call that we hear is to love our neighbor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we distrust our neighbor, if we, if we can't get over that hump of loving our neighbor, well, then are we really following our faith?
Yeah, there's many historians that discuss this, and I cannot remember the events in the past they describe, but they say there's times in history, not the time you've been talking about, but much before that, that were worse.
Sure.
And yet we overcame them.
Mm-hmm.
Another comment is that there's a lot of people in this church that participate in helping the disadvantaged, whether it's investing in Homewood or City Mission, a homeless shelter, or the prison ministry, and there's a bunch of others.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the people that do that find it very rewarding.
Sure.
It not only is helpful in these regards, but it's a source of joy.
I have two comments. One is just, and I don't know who said this, but democracy is one of the systems of government. They're all bad, but it's the least bad.
Yeah, it's usually attributed to Churchill, and it's democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others, all right. Something like that.
Okay. The other comment is, thank you. Whatever group you belong to, political party or whatever, has its own sense of moral force, moral energy. And those forces and energies are defined by their goals and so forth. Is there such a thing as a larger unity that could have a moral force that would overcome the divisions of the Democrat, Republican, Communist, da-da-da-da-da? Is there such a unified moral force big enough to overcome these differences?
Maybe. I mean, one would like to think that Christians of whatever partisan or ideological stripe would think of themselves first as Christians and second as Republicans, Greens, Democrats, Independents, Libertarians, whatevers. I mean, one of the things that we talked about in the first seminar when I was here about polarization is that we've come to, it's that stacking effect of identity so that Christian faith becomes synonymous with Republican Party membership, or if you're progressive, Democratic Party membership. So we don't see Christian faith as a bigger, broader, unifying community or identity. We see it, if we're honest, probably as a subset of political identity. And so too with national identity. You know, prior to, you know, the political scientists tell us, prior to the back end of civil rights into the 70s and 80s, Americans thought of themselves first as Americans and second as Democrats or Republicans. And now the social scientists tell us that we think of ourselves primarily in terms of our partisan identity. And we look at the people on the other, sorry, you're on the other side of the aisle. You did it by sitting here. So we look at the people on the other side of the aisle as not just electoral opponents, like I want my guy to beat your guy, or I want my platform to be implemented rather than yours, but we tend to think of them as less, if not anti-American. You know, just turn on your TV during the ball game and wait for the political ads to come on in between, you know, the sixth inning and the seventh inning. And it's not, you know, Joe Biden has bad ideas and will take the country in the wrong direction, or Donald Trump has bad ideas and he'll take the country in the wrong direction. It's this person will destroy America. This person is not American. So we've also lost our broader socio-political identity that we sort of would hold us together as in us. And we know we've now sort of stuffed that inside of these partisan identities.
Is it, what concerns me is mob psychology, mm-hmm. that people are thinking, oh, that'll be fun, or the need to be with a group, so I'll go and yell. Mob psychology could take over a whole country, as in Hitler getting the masses, and it's happening. When you watch China doing those big parades, and they're so in, it's mob psychology on display, really. So I think that's something that interferes with the purity of when you see a group of protesting. You wonder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we have more than our fair share of groupthink going in our society right now. I think that's fair. Well, it's 10:45 on the button. Thank you again for coming, and we'll see you in the fall.
Thank you. And just a little reminder, next week, 8:45, coffee in the north entry. Come early.